Good morning. The lecture that I'm going to be doing today has to do with basic concepts in rhetoric. It's really designed to get you started and preparing for your informative speech that you'll be delivering in a few weeks, or at least I hope you're listening to this a few weeks before you do your informative speech. It's going to take four class periods for you folks to get through a round of informative speeches, and so I'm hoping that your graduate assistant will be giving you a pretty clear outline of when exactly you'll be speaking over the next few weeks, and certainly a week in advance of having the informative speeches start. This also relates to pages 432 and 453 in the Adler textbook. I'm going to be talking both about some specific issues related to this informative speaking assignment, but I'm also going to be talking about some general concepts of rhetoric, even though you folks have all had an oral communication class or should have had an oral communication class before you get into this class. I think a review of some of the basic concepts of rhetoric and what it is we do and why we do it is kind of important. Let me turn to the first slide, though, because this has some additional guidelines for the informative speaking assignment. Most of this, I think, will be supplementary to the information that's provided on the actual assignment sheet. But let me go through it rather quickly. The first is, remember that the audience that you're giving your speech to is not a contrived audience the way we had it in the group special occasion assignment. It's the audience of your peers that are actually in your section of Comm Studies 103. They're not a board of directors for some big corporation. They are not, a series of folks who are experts in a particular area. They're simply your peers. And it's really incumbent upon you, if you're going to design a good speech, to be sure that that speech and the topic that you choose for that speech are well adapted to the specific audience that you have in front of you, and that is your classmates. So please be sure that as you pick a topic, as you research a topic, as you make assumptions about your specific audience, it's really your peers. And the more you know about your peers, ultimately, the better speech you'll give. Another requirement of this particular assignment is that it be business related. And what I'm really asking for here is that on its face, when you look at the topic of the speech that you've chosen to give, it should be a topic that everybody can say, yep, that's business related. If you have to make arguments with three or four chains that this causes this, and therefore it's business related, it's probably not sufficiently business related. If you have any questions about this, you should certainly contact your GA, or you can send me an email at nburnett@csus.edu, and I could give you certainly some comment on whether or not your topic is sufficiently business related. But it's a big world out there, and you folks have exposure to lots of materials on the business world. I would think finding a business-related topic would be relatively easy. One of the most important criterion in choosing a topic for these informative speeches, these business-related informative speeches, is what I call salience. Salience is how important is the information to you? Do the people in that room need to know that information? Will their lives be benefited by having that information? Is that information just old and obvious to anybody? If it is, it's not very salient. If it's new, if it's vital, if it's something that they need, then you've chosen a topic that has a built-in attraction for the audience in question. You folks are going to be giving informative speeches for four straight weeks in your labs, and that means that it's really up to you about whether or not this class is interesting and vital and provides information that is helpful. If you're choosing stupid, boring topics in the informative speeches, guess what? You have 4 weeks of stupid, boring speeches to look forward to. If rather you spend some time ferreting out topics that are new and interesting, I think you're going to have a fascinating 4 weeks and you'll actually learn a lot. So salience, that is, how important is the information to the people in that classroom? That's really key. A final thing to remember as you choose these topics is that you want to keep these topics and these speeches informative rather than persuasive. And I know there can be a fine line between these two. For instance, you may have to inform people before you can ultimately persuade them. But I think the important issue is, as you think about informational speeches versus persuasive speeches, that in informational speeches, we're trying to expand the audience's range of options. We're giving them additional points of view. That's an informative speech. When we're doing a persuasive speech, we're actually trying to limit the audience's points of view. We want to limit what they find acceptable as a particular policy in response to a particular problem. That's a persuasive speech when you're decreasing the audience's range of options. And so that might be an effective way or a rule of thumb for thinking about informative versus persuasive speeches. Informative speeches expand the audience's range of options, whereas persuasive speeches try to limit or decrease the audience's range of options and have them focus on, say, a particular policy in response to a particular problem. If you're out doing research trying to figure out what topic you should choose for your informative speech, this next slide just gives you some ideas. I would certainly focus on new trends or new services or new problems. I heard, for instance, a report this morning on National Public Radio related to China's food industry and how they were positioning themselves to be leaders in the gourmet food product market. They have an expanding truffle industry in China. They are beginning to lead the way and are producing more foie gras, which is goose liver that's used in a lot of high-end cooking. They're doing great things to increase their production in that area. And they're even beginning to produce caviar with farm-raised sturgeon, as they do down in Elk Grove right here in California. But they're going to be shipping lots and lots more caviar in the future because they're really expanding in these areas. That's an interesting thing because it does impact the market in these kind of exotic food items, and it does threaten the traditional European hold on these particular items. It used to be that pretty much France and Italy had this market to themselves, and how it's going to be challenging the Europeans and how it impacts issues related to food safety. Just recently, when I'm making this tape, China had decided to execute its director of Food and Drug Association, our administration in China, because he had been caught taking bribes from pharmaceutical companies in order to approve drugs. He had been caught really gutting the oversight of food safety in lots and lots of non-certified Chinese food production facilities. And China made their point by actually executing the head politician there, kind of a wake-up call for the people who are working in China's food industry. But again, I think a very interesting informative speech could be kind of crafted out of the business impact of China choosing to enter the high-end food market. You want to think about checking related or business-related websites for reports on new trends and interesting features. I've listed three there that I think you'll find useful. BusinessDaily.com is kind of a mega link site where they link to other websites and reports that they find, and they give you a little brief snippet of information and then give you a link to the other website, and that can be very useful. Morningstar.com is probably one of the really premier business investing websites in the United States. And then, of course, there's just CBSMarketWatch.com. That's a site that, again, is associated with CBS News and has been a pretty standard business reporting site for a long time. I think another way to go about this, instead of being really, really systematic, is, for instance, to simply go to a good bookstore like Barnes & Noble's or Borders and look through their section of business-related magazines. There are lots and lots of both standard and alternative business magazines that I think you will find have very interesting information and might provide you with the kind of spark that you need to pick a really interesting topic. And so whether you're talking about traditional business magazines like Fortune or Forbes or Business Week or even the Harvard Business Review, you also have alternative ones like Fast Company, Red Herring, and of course there are others that I'm not even mentioning. You can just kind of browse through the table of contents of these business-related magazines until you come upon an idea, and then get out there and start your work. So stretch a little, try to do something a little interesting and a little different. Your classmates will reward you for it. Your GA will reward you for it. Again, it's very important that you do the research to back these up. You've got to have specific sources to back up what you're doing. The details are given to you in the informative speaking assignment sheet. It may also be reemphasized by your graduate assistant about the kind of sources that you need. It can't just be based, none of you really are experts in any particular field, and that's why we have you do research to back up these informative speeches. Okay, more on the information speaking assignment sheet that's available online or from your GA. Okay, I think we've probably beat that to death now, and I want to move on to the body of the lecture that talks about the field of rhetoric. If I ask you for your impressions, what you think about when you hear the word rhetoric, chances are the way you've heard it used in the mass media is talking about rhetoric as opposed to action. Some people say, we don't want more rhetoric, we want action. Other people will use the term rhetoric to refer to kind of flowery or purple prose, where they're, you know, again, trying to obfuscate the real source of the core information. Again, I think both of these views of rhetoric are probably wrong. My field in communication study looks at rhetoric as the study of public discourse, the study of public speaking, of oratory, of trying to get your message across in a public situation to particular audiences. That's what the field of rhetoric is really about. And we are lucky to have some very early writings that go back to ancient Greece, and we're talking somewhere between 375 and 350 BC at this point, of in particular the writings of Aristotle. And we have one of the first complete books in the field of rhetoric that we have from Aristotle. And he writes extensively about how it is people come to be persuaded, about how to adapt your speech to a particular audience, trying to understand different audiences and their demographic characteristics and how speakers should adapt to them. Because in ancient Greece, the study of oratory, the study of how to give a good public speech, was one of the critical elements, one of the basic elements in any young person's education in Greek schools. And so there was a lot of time spent thinking and talking about it. I want to move to the next slide that talks about basic rhetorical concepts, and I want to talk briefly about the modes of proof that Aristotle really talked about in his book that we have called The Rhetoric, because he laid out three different ways that speakers use to get to an audience and to get them to believe what it is they're talking about, to come to be persuaded. And even in an informative speech, these are really important elements because they are something that every speaker has to address and think about. The first kind of mode of proof that Aristotle talked about is called ethos. The best modern translation we have for that word is probably credibility, and it has been a kind of fascinating topic of research in my field, not only going all the way back to Aristotle, but even up through the 1950s and 60s. People in my field were still studying what it means to be a credible speaker. What are the dimensions of credibility? How do we break down what this concept is? Because what we're talking about is a kind of proof that resides in the speaker. It's something about the speaker's character that allows an audience to say, yes, I believe what this person is talking about. I find them to be a credible source. The research in this area was pretty consistent in finding that there are actually three dimensions of credibility, three things that went into credibility, and three things that ultimately determine whether or not a public source is credible. Those three areas are, and let me say them first, and then I'll talk about each one of them. First, trustworthiness. The second is expertise or knowledgeability. So expertise is the second. And then the final one is called dynamism. That is being dynamic, being passionate about what you're talking about. So let's talk first about trustworthiness. And we know that this is something that in particular newscasters spend a lot of time worrying about. For years in this country, Walter Cronkite was kind of the dean of American newsmen because he was seen as the most trusted man in America. He had built his reputation in reporting by reporting on World War II, by reporting on Vietnam, by going out into the field and doing the kind of reporting that was necessary. Walter Cronkite was the man who broke the stories and was on the screen for the assassination of John F. Kennedy, for the landing of the first men on the moon. He was kind of part of history and in a lot of ways became the most trusted source in America. Many newscasters would love to have the kind of trustworthiness ratings that Walter Cronkite had. And of course, in their efforts to emulate him, many have failed. If you look recently at the career of Dan Rather, here's Dan Rather again, had the same kind of job that Walter Cronkite had at the same network. And yet towards the end of his career, he was really done in because the people listening to his show really couldn't trust him. The affair with the forged documents related to George Bush's National Guard service and whether or not those documents were in fact true. I mean, even after it was pretty clear to everybody that the documents that Dan Rather had based his report on were probably forged, Rather kept sticking to his guns and defending the source material. And of course, ultimately, it led to his losing his job at CBS. He retired kind of in disgrace, because he really had blown his credibility on the air, primarily because people didn't think they could trust him anymore. The second dimension of credibility that the experts who did research on the area of credibility looked at is called expertise. Do you have a knowledge base that's sufficient for people to believe that you know what it is you're talking about? As you're getting ready to do these public speeches, you've got to be seen as the expert. You've got to have you have to be able to demonstrate to the audience that you've done enough research that you really know what you're talking about up there, that you're not just reading it from some index cards, but that you've done enough research that you really can be trusted as having the correct answers. Being an expert in the field takes time. Being an expert takes research. Being an expert means that you can fairly assess what's good information and what's bad information, and then do that for your audience. The final third element, and the important element, one that we might not have originally expected for credibility, but again and again it showed up in the research, and it's called dynamism. It means, of course, being dynamic, being passionate about what you're talking about, showing a real interest in the topic and a real interest in delivering that message to the audience. Somebody who is very knowledgeable, somebody who is very trustworthy, who lacks dynamism will not be seen as credible as somebody who can really get into a topic. And I think we all know speakers for whom a topic is incredibly involving. If you ever watch Mad Money on CNBC, Jim Cramer is somebody who's an investment counselor that probably is over the top in terms of dynamism. He walks around the set of his TV show giving advice about investment options, and everybody knows how incredibly knowledgeable he is. They know that he's probably reasonably trustworthy, but the place that he really makes up marks is that he's incredibly dynamic, almost to the point of being over the top. So again, those three things really work together to build this notion of credibility. It's what Aristotle would have called years ago ethos, and it's the kind of proof that lies in the speaker. For a different kind of proof, Aristotle turned to the study of the way in which emotions play a role in the audience and getting them to approve of what the speaker is saying. And so the second kind of mode of proof Aristotle talked about was pathos. It's the kind of proof that's found in the emotions of the audience. And audiences have always been vulnerable to speakers that prey upon their emotions, perhaps to the exclusion of some of the other kinds of proof. We can all point to historical figures that perhaps have over-relied on pathos. If you look at the speeches of Adolf Hitler, you'll find that his appeals to the German people were very much kind of encased in this notion that they had been wronged in the past and that they had identifiable enemies among them, and that he used this emotional power to really kind of put a nation on a path to destruction. Before we dismiss pathos, though, as only being a kind of destructive kind of proof, let me also point out that one of the most highly rated political speeches of the 20th century, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, is again almost purely constructed out of pathos. Obviously, there are some issues related to credibility, and there are issues related to logical proof that you'll find in Martin Luther King's speeches. But in particular, the I Have a Dream speech is really built to simply inspire and move to action an audience on the issue of civil rights. And so before we dismiss pathos altogether, let me simply say it's probably a kind of proof that you don't want to rely upon exclusively in a speech, but it can be very important in kind of getting you to the next level. The final proof that Aristotle talked about is called logos, or the proof that's in the word. That logos actually means the word, and it's the kind of logical proof that rhetors construct in order to convince an audience. This is the kind of proof that you'll be going to the library or getting online and trying to find information, statistics, examples, stories, and analogies that ultimately build your case for a particular point of view. When you get to the persuasive speech, we're going to be focusing a lot on logos. And your book does a pretty good job of talking about the way in which we build arguments to try and get our point across. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it here, but for Aristotle, it was probably the most important kind of proof. Another important notion, and one that's really an important one to kind of wrap your head around. People often ask me whether or not that was a good speech. You know, Colin Powell speaking before the United Nations, trying to present the United States' case for war in Iraq. When you ask the question whether or not that was a good speech, I mean, I think if you look at it in isolation, if you look at the way the speech was conducted, if you look at the way it was delivered, it was a very powerful rhetorical moment. But ultimately, that speech failed, because the only way to really know whether or not a speech fulfills its promise is whether or not it works for the audience to which it was directed. The only way to know whether or not you've got good quality proof is whether or not the audience that it's really directed to accepts it. And in the case of Colin Powell, if you look at the speech kind of in isolation, it's probably a very well-constructed speech, very persuasive. But if you look at whether or not it actually did the work it was supposed to do, that is, did it convince the United Nations to go along with the United States on the path to supporting an invasion of Iraq, it failed miserably. In fact, there was even a backlash that people heard the speech and then ran the other way. So I think that as we assess speeches, one of the important things that we'll be asking is whether or not you've been able to adapt that speech well to the particular audience it is intended for. And remember, in this case, when we're talking about informative speeches, it's intended to be delivered to your classmates. If you look at later writings in ancient Greece, and again I'm talking somewhere between 300 BC and 200 BC, you ultimately see a discussion of what are called the five canons of rhetoric. And remember that C-A-N-O-N-S, not C-A-N-N-O-N-S, it's not boom, it's a canon is kind of an art or a sub-art. So when we talk about what are the five things that good speakers really need to master in order to give good public speeches, these are the five canons of rhetoric. And they are, let me lay them out first, you see them there, and then I'll talk about each one very briefly. They are invention, arrangement, style, delivery, and memory. And let me talk about each one briefly. I'm going to spend a little more time talking about invention in just a minute. But ultimately, when we're talking about invention, we're talking about the research and the creation of the speech, the decision about what arguments to use and what arguments to leave out. That's what the invention part of the canons of rhetoric is all about. Next, arrangement is exactly what it talks about. It's how do you logically construct a speech? Which arguments do you choose to put where? What topics do you choose to begin with, and what topics do you choose to end with? There are certain classes of arrangement that seem to work better for different purposes, and that's a lot of what public speaking instruction is still all about, making sure that you understand how to construct a speech logically and for its maximum effect. Style has to do with the language that you use to give a speech in. And I'm not talking about a foreign language versus English. I'm talking about whether you're talking about very technical language. Are you talking about language that's very flowery? Are you talking about language that's loaded with jargon? Again, if you're talking to a more generalized audience, you can't use a highly technical vocabulary to get that speech across. Likewise, if you're talking to a very learned audience who knows their subject very well, they would be insulted by language that was not very technical, that wasn't the language that was used in their field. So you have to think about adapting your style to the audience for a particular speech. Delivery has to do with the skills of the orator to make sure that they use their voice well, that they use their body well in terms of nonverbal communication. And a lot of time and effort is spent in both in ancient Greece and in contemporary public speaking texts to talk about ways of making sure that you use your vocal arts, that you use your voice as a point of strength in developing how to give a speech. In some cases, we'll talk about later on about paralanguage, or what's also called vocalics, where we're talking about the quality of the voice, whether it's very nasal, and mine tends to be a little bit nasal, whether it's very clear or kind of fuzzy, whether it's breathy. Again, those are qualities of speech, and certain kinds of vocal qualities may be more or less persuasive than others. In ancient Greek times, there is, of course, the story, and it might be apocryphal, but we think it's probably true, that one of the great Greek orators by the name of Demosthenes became a great orator primarily because his teacher made him go down to the beach and put lots of small round stones in his mouth and then had him practice his speeches. And what they were trying to do is to make Demosthenes overcome his inability to be very articulate and to be sure that the words that he was saying were very precise. And so by practicing with stones in his mouth, he was actually got to a point where he would be very articulate. He was very easy to understand. Remember, we're talking about times when there's no amplification, when you had to be able to give a speech to 200 or 300 people and make sure that everybody in that audience heard you. And Demosthenes became an excellent public speaker because he paid attention to his delivery, to using his voice well. The final sub-art for the canons of rhetoric had to do with memory. Remember, we don't have index cards in ancient Greece. We don't have facilities for memorizing speeches other than simply doing that, right? We don't have any kind of technology available to these folks. So the result is it was very important for folks to be able to memorize speeches. And the speeches they tended to give in ancient Greece were quite lengthy. We're not talking about 5 to 7 minute informative speeches. We're talking about speeches that might last an hour or more, and they had to be memorized. They had to be committed to memory. And so the ability of an orator to do that was ultimately very, very important. A more recent example involving the importance of memory in public speaking, it's kind of downplayed these days because we have so much technology available to us. Public speakers now often have the use of teleprompters where their entire speech is actually being scrolled on plexiglass plates next to the podium where they're giving the speech. But a recent example from the Clinton administration, he was delivering one of his State of the Union addresses, and it turns out that as he was delivering the speech, the wrong speech was actually playing on the teleprompter. So he's delivering the State of the Union address, and one of his speeches related to healthcare was actually playing on the teleprompter. He did have, of course, a written copy, a manuscript of the speech in front of him, but Clinton is such an excellent public speaker who spent so much time preparing for those things that nobody really detected that he wasn't able to use the teleprompter. One of his aides finally figured out what you know, was going on, and rushed back stage in the House of Representatives chamber to make sure that the tape got switched over and they finally caught up to where Clinton was still doing his State of the Union address. But if you can imagine the panic that it might have gone through most speakers when they found out that what was in the teleprompter was not the speech that they were given, it's a remarkable thing to have a speech memorized. We're not going to be shooting for memorized speeches. We're going to be using what's called extemporaneous presentation, that is presentation from limited notes. It's too difficult, I think, for most people to memorize speeches. And when you memorize a speech, you're memorizing kind of individual words, and you can get stuck and not ever find your way again because there's not going to be anybody there to prompt you. When you use limited notes, when you have the ability to look down and kind of move to the next section, I think that's the kind of speaking that most people do in business settings anyway. They're speaking from limited notes. They're not what we would call canned. Canned speeches are memorized speeches, and they frankly don't look quite as compelling. They're not dynamic. They're not giving you the sense that these people know what they're talking about because they actually have to have it written down and memorized. Let me talk for just a brief moment about invention, which was the first of the sub-arts of rhetoric, of the five canons. I spoke earlier that really what invention is involved with has to do with determining the universe of arguments that might be appropriate to prove a point, and then making sure you adapt them to the speech. And if you look at this particular slide, there are some textbook definitions of invention that might call it, energizing the truth, which is a very dramatic and interesting way to talk about it, but ultimately it doesn't really tell you what invention is. The discovery and adaptation of arguments and material for the speech is probably a better definition of invention. And as I said, it really involves two steps. It involves determining what are the universe of arguments that any individual speaker might use. And you need, the only way to really do that is, for instance, to do research, to go out and try and discover what are the various arguments that one could advance for invoking for allowing a company to kind of put forward a policy that would be described as family-friendly. If we're going to do these family-friendly policies, what are the possible range of arguments that could be given in support of that policy? You may not have time to make all those arguments, but you have to be familiar with all of them. Because then what you have to do is you have to adapt the material that you're going to be presenting to a particular audience. So if you're talking to a room full of parents, selling a family-friendly kind of company might be relatively easy. But if you have young urban professionals, the majority of whom are not married, you may have a different audience and thus need a different set of arguments if you still want to put forward your claim that you want to move your company towards family-friendly policies. So again, invention is important. It's really the discovery and adaptation of arguments and materials for your speech. And it means that you need to get into the library or get online and figure out what are the universe of arguments you could use, and then ultimately which are the best ones to use. I want to also talk about specifically that business of audience adaptation, of making sure that the arguments that you choose are the best ones for the individual audience. There are two kinds of analysis that really form the basis for audience analysis or audience adaptation. And you see there that they are situational analysis and something that you may be more familiar with from your marketing classes, demographic analysis. The situational analysis is really looking at the specific incident of speeches, when that speech is being given, where it's being given, and giving a sense of kind of what's happening with that speech. Why is that particular audience there? Why are those folks gathered for your particular occasion? You also want to look into the question of how many people are you going to be presenting to? Is it a group of five folks from a particular department, or is it a group of stockholders? Is it ultimately something that's going to be intimate, or is it going to be more formal? The time of day that a speech is given can be important. If it's first thing in the morning, people are more likely to be bright and energetic. If it's the last thing at the end of the day, you know, blood sugar runs low and people kind of get tired, and you may need to make more of an effort to get people kind of charged up and interested in your topic. the size of the room that you're giving the speech in. Is it a boardroom or is it a huge auditorium? Do you have amplification, right? Are you speaking on a microphone where you have to be a little more careful about how you articulate and about using that microphone? But whether or not you have even the ability to produce PowerPoint slides for your presentation, or in fact, are you simply going to have to chat with people? Again, those are issues related to situational analysis. But perhaps the most important question you can ask about a particular situation is, what is the attitude of that audience towards that particular topic? Are they hostile? That is, they already made up their mind that they don't like the policy that you're trying to forward here. Are they favorable? Are they already in favor of the point of view? So they're going to, you know, be a little nicer to you when you walk in the door? Or do they not even care? Do they know what their position is? Because they don't understand the topic, or because they don't know that it is even a problem that needs to be solved in their particular organization? So asking the question whether or not the audience is hostile, favorable, or even indifferent is something that every speaker needs to do before they go about their business of building their speech. As I said, if you've had a marketing class, you've probably heard the term demographic analysis, and it's simply the notion that different audience characteristics may lead audiences to react in similar ways. So, for instance, a group of 18 to 21-year-olds might be a different kind of audience than if your audience is between 60 and 65. Age is obviously one of the big issues related to demographics and adapting materials, because I find, for instance, I find myself giving speeches and talking about examples that a younger generation may have trouble dealing with. So, for instance, very few of you remember the Bay of Pigs. Even fewer of you may remember actually living through the time of Watergate and Richard Nixon, which means that I had to change the examples in my speeches to make sure, or perhaps give you the background, to make sure that as I was talking about them, you would understand them. Age can play a huge role in how the speech is being accepted. Even Aristotle, back 350 BC, had a whole chapter on how speaking with older people was very different than speaking with younger people. And he even made some judgments about older folks that we later came to confirm through statistical and research analysis in the 20th century. He, for instance, argued that older people were more politically knowledgeable. He argued that it was tougher to get them to change their minds, all of which has been borne out in research related to persuasion about older versus younger audiences. We know that you need to look at things like group affiliation. If you're talking to a group of professionals who know what it is that you do, you probably can make some assumptions about using jargon or about what those folks are interested in that's different than if you're talking to a more general audience at a different place and time. We know that race and ethnicity can play a role in how people react as an audience, whether or not their religious beliefs are also included. We know that gender is a very important issue that you have to deal with in audiences, and being careful to be mindful about your gender references in your topics. For instance, if when you use pronouns, they're always male pronouns, you may find that the audience that you're talking to gets a little tired of what they regard as kind of a chauvinistic point of view. Why is every manager that you talk about a he? Why is every secretary that you talk about a she? You're kind of gender stereotyping just through the use of pronouns there. And so you want to be mindful about kind of mixing that up a little bit. And believe me, your GAs will certainly be listening for that as well. The final thing that might make a difference is socioeconomic status. We know that certain socioeconomic status folks are interested in different things, and the result is that they may have an effect on the way you give your speech. So as we're thinking about invention, as we're talking about what are the group of arguments that I could advance in presenting a particular point of view, and which ones should I advance, are very different, and you need to do situational and demographic analysis to be sure about that. arrangement was the second of the sub-arts of the five canons of rhetoric. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking here because you've probably had at least some instruction in using organizational patterns and speeches in your first public speaking class or your other oral communication class. You know, for instance, that there are different kinds of organizational patterns that might be more or less relevant for particular speeches. Some of them are listed here, for instance, simply a topical organization. If I was trying to inform you about the rules of baseball, I might use a topical approach and talk about the rules related to the team on offense, rules related to the team on defense, and then a third topic might be related to just general rules of the game. Again, topics related to a particular topic. They're broken down in subtopics. Other organizational devices imply a little more organization. For instance, geographical organization. If I was giving a speech on the problem of air pollution, I might break it down in terms of geography of the United States, and I might talk about air pollution in the East, air pollution in the Midwest, and air pollution in the West, implying that it's kind of a national problem, but that each individual region may have, in fact, different kinds of problems related to air pollution. In the Northeast, it may be more industrial. In the West, it may be more air pollution caused by motor vehicles. Chronological kinds of organizational patterns suggest that the topic that you're dealing with is most effectively seen through a kind of historical approach where you talk about the early times and you talk about the present and maybe you talk about the future. That's a chronological kind of organizational pattern. Or maybe a cause-effect organizational pattern is the best. You talk about a problem's first cause in terms of its cause. How do we get to this point? And then what are the impacts of this particular problem? Okay. Ultimately, any organizational pattern has to have some connection with invention. That is, you've made a choice to feature some particular arguments, and they need to be effectively organized within a particular pattern, and that's when we're talking about the connection to invention. I mean, if I make an argument that, or present a speech that uses a geographical pattern, I've kind of implicitly argued that the problem that I'm talking about is nationwide. If the parts of my speech are the East Coast, the Midwest, the West Coast, that actually implies that the problem that I'm dealing with is something that affects the entire nation. And so as you choose a particular organizational pattern, make sure that it makes sense with, make sure that it has some sense of connection to invention in your speech or the arguments that you've ultimately chosen to present in your speech. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about speech anxiety. Actually, this phenomenon goes by a lot of different names. It's talked about as speech anxiety. It might be called in a certain other circumstances stage fright. I know that in my discipline, if you look it up in the journals, it goes by a different name altogether. It's called communication apprehension. Oh my goodness, yes. So we have to have different names, but really we're talking about that same phenomenon, that feeling that you get when you have to give a public speech that, some of the physical manifestations of stage fright are things like your palms sweating, and you begin to hyperventilate a little bit, and maybe your knees buckle. And for some women, for instance, with very fair complexions, they begin to get big red blotches around their necks. I know that I had a friend who was in graduate school with me, and whenever she had to do a presentation in one of our graduate seminars, she would simply get these big blotches under her neck and on the side of her neck. She was very fair complected. I think she was Norwegian ultimately. And it's not something that she could control. It was something that it simply happened when she had to give a public speech. It was a physical manifestation of speech anxiety. Ultimately, however, when we're talking about speech anxiety, we've done a lot of research on what causes speech anxiety, and we've done some very significant research in how to control it, because it can be very debilitating, and we do know from various surveys that it's still something that afflicts a majority of people in the United States. For many people, it is their number one fear, getting up and actually giving a speech in front of people. They would rather stick their hand in a bucket of bugs than give a public speech, which is simply remarkable from my perspective. Although, I can tell you, I have even had episodes of speech anxiety. When I was in junior high school, I had to get up and give a nomination speech for my friend who was running for class president. And as I got up to give that speech, I can absolutely remember the sweatiness in my palms. I can absolutely remember the effect it had on my breathing. My knees were shaken. I was a mess, and I thought that everybody was sure to see through the speech that I was giving to focus on the physical markers of speech anxiety. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about the research that we've done in the field of communication studies on speech anxiety and give you some suggestions for dealing with it. We would much rather have you deal with this issue of speech anxiety, which some of you may feel, here in a very supportive environment, here at Sac State, than out in the workplace. Because frankly, there are studies that trace the effect of high speech anxiety on your career and your business performance. And the evidence is pretty good. It says that if you are very highly anxious in terms of communicating in public, it will probably have a negative effect on your career. Being able to get up in a public meeting and give a speech, being able to do a briefing, even with limited preparation, these are all skills that we really want you to be able to master. It's one of the reasons why the College of Business Administration has chosen to require this course of all its majors. It's why your accrediting body encourages colleges to have courses like this for you guys. And so let me talk to you a little bit about what we know about speech anxiety. The first thing that you have to remember with speech anxiety is that it's a natural physical reaction to stress. That stress used to be called the fight or flight syndrome. When presented with a threat, your body gets you ready to deal with that threat. Now, if you were talking about back in the time of being a caveman, and you come around a corner and you're confronted by a saber-toothed tiger, you pretty much have two choices. You can either stop there and fight and engage the tiger, or you can turn around and run like hell. Either way, what's interesting is that your body gets you ready to deal with that stress. Certain things begin to happen. Your body begins to have you breathe more rapidly, trying to get more oxygen into your system. You have two little glands that sit on the top of each kidney called the adrenal glands, and they produce a substance called adrenaline, which is kind of the body's own little methamphetamine that gets you kind of amped up, that increases your blood pressure, it increases your heart rate, it increases your breathing, and it gets you amped up to deal with the stress that you're feeling. That's that kind of tightening that you feel as your blood pressure increases. You should understand that it's a natural physical reaction, which means that you probably can't stop it. My friend in graduate school could not control the splotches, the red splotches that came up on the side of her neck. What she began to do is simply wear turtleneck sweaters on days that she was giving presentations. It was simply a natural reaction. Some of them you can control, but others you simply cannot. One of the most important things to figuring out a way to control speech anxiety, to control stage fright, is to understand why it happens, to understand what's going to happen, and then not be shocked when it does happen. Because here's the scenario that can be very, very difficult for people to deal with. They're getting ready to give a public speech, and their body starts to, and of course they're very concerned. They want to do well in the public speech, and they want to make sure that they do a good job. But just as they're getting ready to give the public speech, their body begins to betray them. And what happens is their breathing kind of increases and their heart rate feels like their, you know, heart is pounding out of their chest. Yeah, they feel like you've heard of people having butterflies in their stomach. Well, sometimes it feels like, you know, they have pterodactyls in their stomach. I mean, it just, you have this kind of nauseous feeling as you get ready to give the speech. And then you begin to freak out about the fact that your body is going through these reactions. And so just as you feel like you need control of your body is kind of betraying you. And you begin to get very anxious about the fact that you're having these physical effects. And instead of just being worried about giving the speech now, you're now also worried about what it is that your body is doing. And you know what? That begins to spiral, and it's like a second saber-toothed tiger has shown up. Because now you have two things to freak out about, the speech and the way in which your body is reacting to the speech. And you know what? Those little adrenal glands get pumping, and they pump out more adrenaline, and the whole thing begins to spiral. And instead of just reacting against one problem, you now seem to be reacting against two, and your body begins to kind of dump even more adrenaline, and all of a sudden you find yourself on a spiral of anxiety that's very difficult to deal with. The truth is that lots of people still suffer from speech anxiety. Performers will tell you that they still get stage fright before going out before a live audience. Athletes will tell you that the stories that they have of having to perform in front of large crowds. One of the most popular and skilled basketball players of all time from the Celtics, one of the classic centers, Bill Russell, would, for instance, before every game that he played, have to throw up. And then he knew that, and his coach, Red Auerbach, knew that, and it was just something they came to expect. He didn't get crazy about it. He didn't go nuts. He simply made sure that he left time to throw up before he went out to play the game of basketball. And in fact, Red Auerbach, before a very famous seventh game matchup between the Milwaukee Lakers and the Celtics, actually held the team in the locker room until just before tip-off because Bill Russell had not thrown up and he didn't want to do anything to change the routine that Bill had established for himself over the years. You learn to adapt, and I'm not suggesting that you, you know, take some time to make sure that you have time to throw up before you give your public speech. But what I'm suggesting is that you understand that your body's physical markers to anxiety are normal and natural, and it's simply going to happen. Another thing that we've learned from the research on public speaking is that speech anxiety tends to peak right at the beginning of a speech, and then after a minute or so tends to decrease. That is, that we get most amped up right at the beginning of a speech, and then as we kind of realize that, you know, we're not going to fall apart, or we're not going to pass out, or the audience is not going to be able, going to start to throw ripe fruit at us, that we're probably going to make it through this very stressful event, our levels of anxiety, at least as they're self-reported, begin to decrease. That will be important when we talk about ways to deal with speech anxiety in just a minute. But let me tell you the best news that comes out from research on speech anxiety. And it has to do with the perception of the audience and how nervous they believe a speaker is. And the good news is this. Studies that have been done in the area of communication study have consistently shown that audiences underestimate speech anxiety. That is, they can't see your heart rate fluttering. They can't feel the pterodactyls in your stomach. They don't understand how nervous you are. And so if you ask, for instance, individual speakers to rate themselves on a scale of 1 to 10 about how nervous they are, they might say, oh my God, I was an 8.5. Whereas if you ask audience members for that same speaker, how nervous do you think the speaker appeared, they'll say something like, wow, it really looked like she had it together. I would say maybe a 3.5 or a 4. So it's very interesting, and actually you can use this to your advantage, that audiences consistently underestimate speech anxiety. The reason that's very important is we can use that as a tool for dealing with speech anxiety, and that's actually what my next slide is about. If you're looking for ways to deal with speech anxiety, let me offer a couple of obvious, maybe not so obvious, hints. The first thing is that you want to avoid avoidance. Here's the problem. If we've determined that giving public speeches make us uncomfortable, that we get these markers of speech anxiety and we don't like them, what tends to happen is that we tend to seek out ways to avoid giving public speeches. We skip the class that requires a big presentation at the end, or we decide to have somebody else in the department give the briefing every morning. Whatever it is, we tend to avoid things that we don't like. This is just classic stimulus response theory. Well, here's the problem. The more you don't do a public speech, the more you put off practicing and dealing with that anxiety, the bigger it gets. And so by avoiding participating in the stimuli, that is, by avoiding giving the public speech, you may actually be making the problem worse. It's one of the reasons why we want you to do a bunch of speaking tasks here in this class over the course of this semester, because one of the ways for you to deal with your speech anxiety was to see that you can actually get through some of these assignments, that you have the ability to do what you need to do to get the speaking assignments dealt with, and that means that you'll get some confidence so that as you approach other speaking situations, you'll have the confidence that you can get through them. Again, much better to deal with this kind of issue here on a campus in a relatively low-threat environment. I mean, seriously, the people in your classes are all hoping that you're going to do well. It's not like there's a limited number of good grades in any particular class. And so they're supportive. They want you to do well. They want you to succeed. That may not be the case when you get out into the business world. So you want to avoid avoidance. You want to embrace the notion that you get out there and practice. For some people who need continual practice or additional practice and feeling better about their level of anxiety, you may actually want to seek out ways in which you can practice your public speaking. And for instance, there is a new group on campus, actually a branch of a group that's worldwide and in fact very well known, called the Toastmasters. And what the Toastmasters do is they meet once a month or once a week, whatever their frequency is, to get together and practice public speaking with one another. And I know it sounds a little weird, but I think you'll find that the Toastmasters Club at Sac State is made up of both students and staff who are interested in improving their public speaking skills, and they offer very low-threat, supportive environments for people learning to do that. So you might look into it. My second bullet there may seem very obvious, but let me tell you, the last thing that you need to do to help your body would be to go out and be slamming a quadruple latte or, one of these energy drinks. Oh, my God. You know, the last thing you need is to be doing a couple of Red Bulls before you come in to do your public speech. Because remember, one of the things that your body does is it provides the same kind of stimulus. The adrenaline that is going to be pumping out of those little adrenal glands is the same kind of stimulant that you get from caffeine, that you get from these energy drinks. And you don't need to be artificially medicating yourself with any more of this. Avoid caffeine prior to doing these speeches, and I think you'll find that your body is easier to regulate, because you're really kind of putting the pedal to the metal when you both deal with your body's response to these stresses and then medicate yourself by having a quadruple cappuccino or something like that. Practice, 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 right? How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. How do you overcome speech anxiety? Really, it's about practicing more and more to the point where you get very comfortable with the speech that you have to give. The problem is, of course, that if even practicing your speech sets up the markers of speech anxiety, people tend to practice less. And then you know what? You really are in a bad place, because in addition to not having practiced very much, you also haven't experienced what you experience for the markers of speech anxiety. So when they hit, you're less familiar with them, which begins the spiral of anxiety. And the fact that you haven't practiced very much means that you may not be given a very good speech, which means you really do have something to be nervous about, which means, you get my drift here, right? It gets worse and worse and worse. So you want to practice a speech. You want to talk it out loud. Not merely think about it, but you actually want to give your speech to a roommate, to your little brother, to your dog, whatever. practice speaking the speech out loud, because then you get used to the timing, you get used to the flow. A speech that's 5 to 7 minutes in your head may be 20 minutes long when you get to the classroom. So you need to work on practicing that. As I said a moment ago, research seems to suggest that speech anxiety tends to be at its highest in the first couple of minutes of your speech. Well, if that's the case, what we know then is, as you're preparing for your presentations, you want to really concentrate on being able to nail the first couple of minutes of your speech. Because if you can get through that, if you can go through that introduction and get through into your first point and do it in a way that you feel confident, that you really know that material, if you have to, privilege any part of your speech to practice a lot, practice the first couple of minutes, because that's when you're most likely to be the most anxious. You get through those 2 minutes, you have success, you're feeling like you're doing a good job, your speech anxiety level is going to decrease for the rest of that speech. As you're sitting in your seat getting ready to give your speech, your body is going to begin to react, and your body is going to have certain markers of speech anxiety. And one of the best ways to kind of control all of that is to practice deep, slow breathing, to be sure that you're just you're modulating your respiratory system by having deep breaths instead of short, rapid breaths. That will make sure that you have sufficient oxygen in your system. It will perhaps do a little bit to control your heart rate and your blood pressure. But deep breathing as you're sitting there waiting to give your speech is probably a good way to kind of practice these things. You also want to avoid bottling up nervous energy. I see some speakers get up to a podium and they'll put a death grip on the podium as they're there to give their speech. And then sure enough, soon their arms begin to flap. They look like, Big Bird. Or their toes begin to tap. We get toe tappers all the time. And it's because nervous energy is kind of leaking out of their bodies. If you're a little more relaxed by not gripping the podium and you're able to walk around in the front of the room, to move in order to emphasize particular points in your speech, to connect with your audience because you're not behind the podium anymore, that's a really good way, I think, ultimately to deal with all this nervous energy. Let me talk about one final treatment that people sometimes use for very severe cases of speech anxiety. The treatment of speech anxiety is very similar to the treatment of phobias. And one of the methods that psychologists and therapists have used over the years in treating phobias and speech anxiety is called systematic desensitization. That's systematic desensitization. And really what we're talking about is gradually exposing yourself to the stimuli to a point where it no longer makes you crazy nervous. Let's talk about a classic kind of phobia that people have, the fear of flying, right? A lot of people don't like to fly on airplanes. One of the ways that people treat that is by systematically exposing people to the stimuli to the point where they can actually function. So, for instance, in your first treatment for speech anxiety, you may simply do nothing more than drive past the airport off-ramp on I-5. Right? We go past it. Look, there's the sign to the airport. You've been exposed to the idea of airport and you're able to live through it. You begin to understand how your body's going to react. Maybe the next time in your treatment, you actually drive through the airport. You never even stop. You simply get off on the off-ramp for the airport and you drive through Sacramento International and you come back and you get back on the freeway. And again, you've exposed yourself to the stimuli, but you haven't actually kind of begun to fly yet. Maybe the next time you'd actually go to the airport and you'd get out of the car. And the time after that, you'd go to the airport and you'd get out of the car and actually go into the terminal. In some of these treatment programs for people who are very anxious about flying, they have a real fear of flying, they actually have situations where they rent gates at the airport and rent airplanes for people to actually go in and sit down inside airplanes. They never even take off, right? But they're just getting used to the stimuli. They're exposing themselves to the stimuli, that is the fear of flying, gradually over a long period of time to the point where they actually can feel comfortable or at least reasonably comfortable in flying. And again, a public speaking treatment for severe speech anxiety would do something very similar. You might simply sit in the back of the class where speeches are going on. The therapist may ask you to imagine yourself giving a speech. You may actually write a speech without doing a public performance of it. You may then actually give a very brief performance. And if you think about the way the assignments are structured in this class, where you're able to get up for your introductory speech with another person, where you're able to get up in the group special occasion speech, and you don't even have to be yourself, you can be somebody else. Again, what we tried to do is ease you into the public speaking situation. And one of the reasons we do that is we know that there are lots of folks out there who are very speech anxious. Use this class, use the assignments in this class to test out how speech anxiety is for you. If you find that you're very speech anxious, you may need to take additional steps to feel better and better about doing that kind of speaking, because ultimately we do know it can affect your career. People who are very speech anxious do not progress in their careers against similar folks with similar training and similar educational backgrounds. It really can be a key element of how you progress in your career. So take these opportunities, take the advantage of being able to speak in front of a supportive classroom of your peers, and go from there. I'm on a slide now, moving to an area called Special Considerations for Your Informative Speech, and really it's just some final suggestions as you prepare for that informative speech assignment that you'll be doing soon. One of the first things you want to think about is make sure that you understand the knowledge level of your audience. I've seen dreadfully boring informative speeches delivered where the audience member has chosen to get up and talk, for instance, about contributing to a 401k. And what a great idea is this for a young employee. But you know what? Everybody else in the class has had the same finance and the same investment classes that you've had, and they probably already know all about 401ks, and they probably know it's a good idea to take advantage of the time value of money and put some money in their 401ks early on so that by the time they retire, that they're going to be doing pretty well. Make sure you understand what your colleagues know and what they don't know, and an informative speech is one that gives people information that they don't know. If they already know it, there's very little salience for them. There's very little reason for them to pay attention to you. So you are really obliged to make sure that you know what your audience knows and then begin to help fill in some of those gaps. A second idea for giving an informative speech is to use other time savers rather than jargon. I'm going to be talking about the use of jargon in the language and nonverbal communication lecture. You may or may not have already listened to that. But remember that one of the things that happens when you're speaking to an audience of your peers that have a high degree of technical knowledge in a particular area is that we tend to use time-saving devices in language that are called jargon. We use shortcuts. We use abbreviations. We use a style of language that may be very dense to people who are outside of our discipline, who don't understand what it is that we do, but we use that language because everybody seems to know it. Well, remember that most of the people in your class are not going to have the same knowledge level on the topic. You're the one who's going to be the expert. You're the one who's gone out and done the research. And so it's very important that you consider using other ways to save time. We use jargon because it's a shortcut. We use jargon because everybody understands what the acronyms mean. But in a general speech class like this, you may not be able to use the same kind of jargon. And as a result, you may need to use more visual aids. You may need to use other ways of illustrating what it is you're talking about in order to save time. One of the sure ways to be sure that people are going to understand the technical level of your speech is to present as a part of your practicing the speech. Give the speech to somebody who does not have that technical background. Make sure they can understand what it is you're talking about. If you're having trouble figuring out whether or not something is too technical, a guaranteed way to deal with it is to give it to a non-technical audience for review and see if they can understand what it is you're talking about. A final thing to think about as you do your informative speech is to sensitize, and maybe this is actually more of an idea for when you're giving presentations in business. I think it's a really good idea to sensitize your audience, that is, to deal with upfront the notion of whether or not you would welcome interruptions in your speech. in class, people are not going to interrupt you. Nobody's going to throw up their hand in the middle of your speech and say, hey, I didn't understand that at all. Would you please explain that a little more? But that's exactly what might happen when you're doing a briefing, when you're presenting a final report in business. And so I think you ought to begin your speech a little bit by talking with that audience about whether or not you'd welcome a question from the audience, or would you prefer that they simply hold their questions because you may in fact answer their question in the course of your presentation, and that ultimately you will be able to then answer their questions that they might have at the end of your presentation. I think it's always a good idea to set some ground rules so that you don't get surprised. You don't want to be peppered with questions if you're not comfortable having the flow of your speech interrupted, right? If you do better by simply having to make the presentation and then deal with questions and answers at the end, or if you have to rely, for instance, on other people to help you answer questions, it's almost always a good idea to simply tell your audience that you'd like to make your presentation and that you will entertain questions at the end. That then gives them a hint that that's how you'd ultimately like to handle things. I think that's a real good idea for real-world business presentations. As I said, nobody's going to probably interrupt you in class. We're going to wait patiently and kind of politely, and then if we do have questions about your topic, your GA will probably ask for questions at the end. But in a business situation, you know, the boss interrupts and says, you didn't explain that very well. Tell me what you're talking about. Or why do those figures conflict with the figures that I've gotten from the main headquarters, right? Those kind of questions will come up, and if you want to handle questions differently, you need to kind of give people some ideas. We're about to the end of this presentation. There are still, though, three more slides in the PowerPoint presentation that you may want to spend some time reviewing. We're presuming that as people come into this class, that they've met the prerequisite that said that you had at least one other oral communication class before coming into Comms 103. And so as a result, we're not going to spend a lot of time in this class talking to you about how to actually do your speech, how to write it, how to construct introductions and conclusions and transitions. But it may also be that it's been a while since you've had that public speaking class. And so what I've done at the end of this particular PowerPoint file is given you three slides that focus on exactly those things. Introductions, transitions, that is moving gracefully from one part of your speech to another, and conclusions, three of the most difficult parts of your speech, three things that you do have to think about in advance, three things that you can't just do on the fly. And it talks about what are the goals for good introductions and ultimately the methods for seeking those goals. How do you get from here to there? That's what transitions are all about, and why is it that you use them? And then again, for conclusions, we look at what is a good conclusion supposed to do and how do you ultimately construct a good conclusion for a public speech. We don't want to get up and hear people in these classes saying, my speech topic today is... That's an awfully bad introduction. It's not very creative. We don't want to hear conclusions that end a speech by saying, well, I guess that's it. We want people who think creatively about introductions and conclusions and transitions, and that they use those as an effective way of structuring their speech. You can work with this information on your GA. There is additional information in your Adler textbook about these particular topics, but the PowerPoint slides are at least a point of jumping off. You may talk about these specifically in the speech prep day in your once-a-week lab with your GA. It kind of depends on how the schedule exactly works out, but at the very least, I wanted to present that information to you. Thanks again. This is the end of the information and public speaking kind of part of this lecture. It's an introduction to rhetoric, and I thank you for your time.